Uncommon leaders have a major ability to build on their strengths, and this ability is characteristic of successful managers. They ask, where is my organization going? What are the strengths of my people? What are my individual strengths as a contributor? There are two different approaches that a manager might pursue in deciding how to deal with the people working for him or her. Either pay attention to their weaknesses, problems, deficiencies, and try to clean those up, or deal primarily with the strengths and assets and opportunities that exist in those people. There isn't any easy answer as to which is the best approach, but effective managers tend to favor the concept of building on strengths and discounting weaknesses. People are always a mixture of strengths and weaknesses. If you look at objective psychological testing data, you'll find that most people perform some functions very well. They may have outstanding intelligence or strong social relationships, or they're one of the hardest working people on the production line. They have one or two or three characteristics of strength, usually not 23 or 47, but a few things that they do exceptionally well. At the same time, when looking at the testing data, you find that most people have many more weaknesses than they have strengths. As Will Rogers said, all men are ignorant, only on different subjects. So a manager, as he or she deals with an imperfect person, must decide to approach this person either on the basis of trying to overcome their deficiencies or deal with them on the plus side and try to build on their existing strengths. Have you ever worked for someone whose primary focus was dealing with your weaknesses? It's almost as though this individual had decided that if they could somehow straighten you out in those areas of negative performance, then you would be perfect. It's almost as though they said, I'm going to back up my little asphalt truck and fill in the potholes of your personality. To some extent, these managers are trying to change people. You can see this, for example, in the way they run a performance appraisal session. You come into their office, they sit down with you, spend 3 minutes telling you what a terrific job you've done this last year, and then pull out all the ancient archaeology of every little thing you've done wrong for the last 12 months. After an hour of this, your ego has been sacrificed, and you've been through a very negative experience. Effective managers know that even professional psychologists and counselors trained in very advanced techniques are seldom able to change people. If you talk with professionals in the behavioral sciences, they wouldn't even claim that they wanted to change a person or make him or her something other than what they are. The goals of psychotherapy are very limited. They seek an adjustment to help the person understand the way he is and to live with who he is. So professionals in the field tend to have very limited goals in mind. In fact, their goals are much more realistic than the goals many ineffective supervisors set for themselves. For instance, in performance appraisal, effective managers make it a positive, ego-building kind of experience. There is no such thing as constructive criticism. In such an interview, we often see the effective manager praising the employee for all the many achievements over the course of the last year. And if it's necessary to discuss something negative, they use a suggestive manner to point out new areas to develop. Many managers will spend the majority of the session time planning work to be done in the next 6 months. These managers ask the employee what he or she will need to accomplish this new task. And so the orientation is future-focused on what the employee can do. These managers are always reminding people of who they are and what they can do, rather than reminding them of what they are not and what they can't do. A story out of history may serve to make the point. When Abraham Lincoln was elected president, he had to go to Washington to fight a major war. He didn't know anything at all about warfare. Certainly his was an unpleasant presidency. It was a terrible period of our history. Some advice that Lincoln received when he arrived in Washington was that his commander of the Grand Army of the Republic be a soldier who basically had no weaknesses. This man should be a soldier who had the respect of the military establishment. Another suggestion was to find a commander with politically powerful friends, people in high places, people in the Senate. He was also supposed to be somebody who was pretty smooth on the social circuit, someone who could charm all those people who made decisions. It should be somebody who was pretty bright, probably graduating near the head of his class at West Point and so forth. In short, the shopping list of the suggestions given to Lincoln indicated an individual with no weaknesses. Lincoln went through a list of generals who had nothing in the way of surface weaknesses. The problem was, however, that they had no record in terms of winning battles. It is a historical fact that in the first 3 years of the Civil War, the Union Army won no major victories. Lincoln then made a breathtaking decision. He appointed a man who had a number of notable weaknesses. The man was a public drunk. He literally had fallen down in the street cold drunk and had been hauled back to camp in the grain wagon. He used profanity. He avoided going to church. He was far from the darling of the military establishment. In fact, he almost flunked out of West Point. This individual was, in short, as contrary to the list of criteria Lincoln had been given as you could imagine. When it was revealed who had been appointed, people were aghast. One person said to Lincoln, "My God, Mr. Lincoln, you have appointed a man who is a public drunk." And Lincoln responded by saying, "If I knew what brand he drank, I would send a barrel of it to all my other commanders." Though he had many weaknesses and many failings, Ulysses Simpson Grant had also a single overriding strength. He won every battle he ever fought. Shortly after he took command, the Union Army scored major victories at Gettysburg and Vicksburg. Grant didn't have the great strategic genius of Robert E. Lee. He didn't win with a lot of finesse. He employed simple, bloody confrontation, but he won. Lincoln finally understood the major executive lesson. You can only build on what you've got, and if the person has some strengths, utilize them. But what do you do about the weaknesses? Well, you're not going to find anyone without them, so you're just going to have to discount them. You're going to have to tolerate them. You're just going to have to look the other way. You could wish they had more common sense, but in fact, you're going to have to be very tolerant and very forgiving. Occasionally, the problem is going to be one that you have to say something about, and sometimes a little counsel will help the person. Sometimes they can change. But when they can't, you as an executive are going to be put on the firing line. Others will be critical of the fact that you're keeping people with real negatives in performance or personality. It may help to remember that these people are on your payroll to perform. They aren't being paid to conform to somebody else's idea of a perfect personality. You'll have the same problem Eisenhower had when he was trying to hold the Allied armies together and keep all of the political factors in balance with a great general who was very much like Grant. General George Patton had great strengths, but he had a lot of weaknesses. Patton was continually criticized in the press, and he did some things that were dumb. But if you had to fight, and you needed somebody who could win in impossible situations, George Patton was the guy you'd want for that job. So what Eisenhower did was fight the political battles, cover for Patton's failings, until he could use Patton's strengths. That kind of decision-making is a classic example of what effective people in leadership roles do with people who are mixtures of strong positives and strong negatives. Think about the people working for you. You might want to write down a list of Mary's strengths. List her weaknesses too, and then forget them. What are Bill's strengths? What is it that he can do exceptionally well? How can you use Bill's strengths even more? He's fabulous with people, a great project organizer. Maybe you'll also identify his weaknesses. He's not the best person technically. And then you're going to forget the weaknesses. It's been said you shouldn't use people. I'm going to say exactly the opposite. People want to be used. The key to achievement motivation and getting people excited at work is to use them. Use them where they can be successful. That means using their strengths. Effective leaders are very quick to upgrade people in terms of their job description and responsibilities. They are very quick to give people demanding jobs. Now, I realize that some would object to my saying to forget or overlook their weaknesses as too strong a statement. Okay, if you want to spend a little time trying to help people develop their weak behavior, to counsel them about things they should try to avoid doing, that's fine. But do you hear the point I'm making? Are you focusing your time and effort in sufficient amount in building their strengths as a majority of your emphasis? Effective managers show us that is exactly what has to be done. Average managers think you should give both sides of the equation roughly equal attention, and lousy managers focus on weaknesses. Where are you on this continuum? You may want to look for ways to increase the job enrichment potential, to increase the content of the job, or to increase the authority level of the jobs of your people. Give them more work than they're doing now. Give them increasingly heavy loads, not just more scut work, but meaningful and challenging tasks. How can you tell what this person can do until you load them up with more to do? Sometimes I'm afraid we look at a person in a present job, let's say as a secretary, and we say to ourselves, well, she couldn't do that new task. She's just a secretary. When we've made a comment like that, we've just placed ourselves among the losers in management. Let me tell you a true story of a large company and how they violate systematically the build-on-strength principle. This particular organization requires a bachelor's degree in accounting for staff consultants in their organization, a major accounting firm in the United States. A number of secretaries within this firm became interested in working up to a staff consulting job. They were career-oriented and had gone back to school. When they finished their studies as a group and received their degrees in accounting, they asked for reassignment into the higher-level position as a staff consultant. The staff consultant job was typically given to college kids right out of school with no knowledge at all of the firm's internal organization or procedure. Whether you can believe this or not, this organization turned down every single one of those secretarial requests. They reasoned these women couldn't be professionals. They were just secretaries. Now, what happened to those people and the strengths that they represented? They had 10 and in some cases 15 years of experience with this organization, plus close working relationships with clients. They knew the systems, personalities, market strategies, and so forth. And they went as a group across the street and peddled their talent to a major competitor who was very quick and willing to give them an assignment. Whenever you hear that somebody can't be given more responsibility, don't tolerate it. Don't accept it. Fight for that person's opportunity. Your job is to use people. Your job is to increase their load, because no one can rate the potential of another human being. You can't look at any employee in your unit and say that person only has so much potential. Give them demanding jobs. Give them the authority. Sometimes managers have difficulty delegating. There are some laws of delegation that are sometimes useful to keep in mind, particularly when managers worry that the job they're delegating won't be done as well as they themselves might do it. It's possible that such a concern may be accurate. Someone else might not be able to do quite as well. Yet if they had some time to learn and the freedom to make some mistakes, they might learn, they might grow, and they might become stronger. And that is a risk effective managers routinely take, because they believe in betting on people. The effective manager understands the driving philosophy behind some tongue-in-cheek maxims about delegation. First, that a half-baked job is better than no job at all. Management, you know, is not perfection, it's improvement. If somebody else can get a step down the road with the problem, that's a lot better than not starting the trip. Are you at a point in managerial maturity where you're willing to accept getting the job done partially by an associate rather than having no job done at all because you didn't have the time to do it yourself? A second of these maxims is that a half-baked job is better than doing it yourself. The manager has more than enough to do in trying to get KRAs accomplished. If you want to be the whole show, you're never going to be successful. The name of the game in management is getting results through others. And so a half-baked job is often better than doing it yourself. The third of our sayings is to never put off until tomorrow what you can get someone else to do today. One of the things that effective management calls for is pacing, action, urgency. One of the things we absolutely can say with assurance is that there is no success in mañana management. Putting things off until tomorrow so that you can do them is not nearly as effective a strategy as letting somebody else get started today. Finally, the last of our tongue-in-cheek maxims in the area of delegation is that the great key to delegation is to delegate like hell and then follow up. Delegation is not abdication. Get rid of everything possible, but then make sure that others are getting it done. Now, in any management team, you're going to have some superstar performers, and you're also going to have some people who are second stringers. It's been said that the only thing in abundant supply is the universal incompetent. That's a little cynical, perhaps, but largely true. There are very few people who are strongly above average in their performance. Most people are average performers. That's what the concept of the average means. It describes most people. In your organization also, you're going to have two kinds of work. You're going to have problems, and problems are usually something that has gone wrong with a system that was designed yesterday and is operating today in poor fashion. I'm going to suggest that if you take your strongest players, and you may have only one or two, and you assign that strongest player to a problem, you've just made a mistake. A problem is generally a routine kind of thing. It's a lesser concern. That superstar ought to be assigned instead to work that is of an opportunity nature. The word opportunity is something associated with the future, not the past. It is a problem which, if developed today, will help better serve the needs of tomorrow. Because it is only an opportunity, it's not very well structured right now. Nobody can tell you how to do it. It's going to take some pretty sharp thinking to figure out how to make this opportunity come to pass. But if you take your strongest person and assign him or her to yesterday's problems, it means that you've sacrificed future opportunities. So superstars have to be played in very key positions. What I'm saying is, don't treat everybody alike when it comes time to assign work. Devote your best brains to opportunities. Devote the average performers to existing problems. It may take longer for the average person to solve those problems, but it will be a growth experience for them, and they won't be sidelined watching the superstar get all the credit. One last important question in the area of building on strengths. What are you going to be doing today? One of the reasons that you're in a position of responsibility is that your management believes in you. They're betting on you, just as effective managers bet on other people. They believe that you have what it takes, and whatever the relationship between you and your boss right now, the fact is that he or she is expecting great things of you. And so when you come to work in the morning, ask yourself this question as you drive into the parking lot. What one thing of significance will I accomplish today? What one thing of significance will I accomplish today? Not only does that keep you focused on key results areas, it keeps you focused on the fact that you are one of the strengths in your unit, a key strength that must be used to its utmost.